Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from England, Emily Tull. Emily, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Gary.
Oh, thanks for doing this. All right, now the first question is, you are clearly a much more than adequate oil painter. I mean, okay. I really, and I mean that in the most positive way. I mean, I really enjoyed looking at your paintings. How is it that an oil painter, because you'd think once you get that kind of skill level that you would stick with it, how is it that you transitioned to needlework? What happened to you?
I was frustrated, actually, with my painting.
Okay. I enjoyed it, so deal with that.
Me up. No. The thing is, I love how I paint. So I'm a palette knife painter. I'm quite quick. I don't spend a lot of time with the painting, and I work quite large when I painted, you know, at least 2 foot by 3 foot kind of size wise, and I just spend a couple of days on the work. But the problem is, in my head, I really craved really fine detail. Now, I'm not going to get that fine detail with a palette knife. So I didn't want to change the way I work with the paint because I enjoyed that. That's me coming out, you know, that's my expression of painting. And I didn't want to change that. So I had to kind of find a different way to kind of get this, how I was going to get a fine detail. You know, I really, really wanted that. And it was kind of really a weird kind of journey into then kind of stitching, which then got me that kind of fine detail that I was after. Back when I was a student, see, doing my degree, I saw in a gallery in London, it was a really simple landscape, just black stitching done by machine on white fabric, and it was just basic outlines of trees, and there was a couple of buildings. And I thought, oh, never seen that kind of work before in the gallery. That's really interesting, like, you know, using the machine. And it was a male artist as well, which kind of, I think, quite stuck in my head as well at that point. Then, you know, I buy magazines, and a couple times other stitch work, but hand embroidered work had come up with portraits, but they looked like drawings. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. Just kind of stuck it away in my head. And then I thought one day, back in 2006, one evening, I thought, I'm going to have a go at that. Just borrowed some Redstone, black, white, a dark and a mid-grey and a brown. And I got a photograph. And over a few nights, I just stitched. I did a light pencil drawing. And then I stitched over the top, and I didn't stretch the fabric. It wasn't in a hoop or anything. It just sat on my lap and I sat in a chair watching TV. Quite enjoyed it. That was fun. Reminded me of drawing. It was interesting to be sitting on using the fabric and not stretch, because then I was getting all these folds in it. And then I just put it away, just folded it up, put it away, and kind of forgot about it. And 2 years later, I was still painting, but I hadn't painted as much, and I was kind of just, I really needed to find something at this point to kind of move me on. I was working on a commission for a band, well, for a musician, and they were doing an Alice in Wonderland theme. So I'd done some illustrations for them, and then they wanted this 3D human-sized march hare to be on the stage with them. And I made that out of willow, because another part of my art life is I work on community projects. So I work on lantern parades and carnivals and things. So I use willow as a lot of framework for those. So I had some willow, and that's what I made the body and the head from. The legs were kind of just simple parts that were then going to be added, and they could pose him in, dress him up in whatever clothes they wanted. So the head and the body needed to be covered in a fabric that was going to be more on show. So I thought, oh, okay, I've got, well, I over here we call it Hessian, you call it sacking and burlap, is it?
Burlap, yes.
Mm-hmm. Burlap. And I thought, right, that's what I'm going to cover it in. So I thought, right, how am I going to cover it? And I thought, oh, okay, I've got embroidery floss. I'm going to stitch it on. So it's brown, so it kind of fitted in. And while I was stitching it onto this willow, well, that's interesting. I wonder if I could stitch a face onto this fabric. Now, I don't quite know where that really was coming from, because obviously that fabric quite holy, really. It's got, big gaps in the makeup of it. And so I had to kind of have a think about that. And I had some scraps left over from the project. And also in my paintings, I'll jump back a bit there, I also painted through fabrics. So things like really fine netting and like mesh fabric. So I used to load up my palette knife and have the material up against my canvas, and then I'd load up the paint over them, press the paint through the fabric and rip it away. And so it was quite accidental how the paint would come through, and it was quite mottled. And that's how I would do a lot of my skin tones that way, using that technique. So I had lots of these really fine fabrics, like scraps lying around. And I thought, okay, I think I could work out how I could possibly get another layer to fill in these gaps in the sacking material, so I could actually stitch a face. So I had what we call muslin. I don't know what you might, if you call it muslin in the US. So I just put a piece of that onto the fabric, pinned it on, did a very rough drawing of my eye as a tester, borrowed some cottons from my mum because I didn't really have any. And it was very crude what I did, and I kind of cringe when I look at it, but I really, because it's so simple in colors, it was just a white, blue, some metallic cottons were put in there as well because I didn't have any of the right colors. But I really liked the process, the kind of control, that kind of sense of drawing, because I do love drawing. And I could see how I could possibly develop this into getting what was inside my head of what I wanted to do with my paintings. So I went and got some more colours, not many. I probably still had less than 10 for the first three portraits I ever did. So there were three male faces that I did. And I think the first one I did was of my brother, just because there was no way he was going to say no to me to being the model, because I painted him before.
I have a sense your brother is kind of a fill in for everything.
I know. He's asking for permissions now on all the pieces that I do of him. But, I knew his face really well. So, and I feel right. If this doesn't work, then fine. I've not kind of wasted, people outside of my family's time kind of thing on this.
Right.
So, I just used the scraps that I had of the muslin. And the first three pieces, they're really quite minimal. The amount of stitching, when I look at photos of them now, there's so much of the muslin showing through. So this muslin is really the skin of each of the portraits, and the stitching that I did, there's so little of it, but it just adds a little tonal quality to them. The only bits that have really got any kind of amount of stitching is probably the eye area and maybe the mouth, but not overly stitched. And the mouths still had metallic colors. They all had metallic pink in them as well, which always made me laugh at the time. I'm going, ooh, not quite sure about that, but it kind of worked. That's like glisten of lips. So I'd done these first three and I really liked them. I thought, okay, they really look like the people that I've got, that they're of. And I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with this. I didn't know if I was going to continue stitching after these three, but luckily one of the companies that I worked for doing the the lantern parades and things also own a gallery, and they were just opening a new one local to me, and they were doing an open show, and I said, could I put these pieces in? And they had a look and they said, yeah, of course. So I thought, great, this is going to be a tester for me to really see how people react, because obviously they know me as a painter, but you know, how are they going to feel about this, even though it was portrait still? And I got a great reaction from them. And so while it was on display, I actually entered into another portrait competition in Birmingham in the UK and got two of the pieces accepted. So I actually had to take them out the other show and make a couple of pieces for the other show. They let me do that. It's lucky they know me. And I got highly commended for one of those pieces. So that was it for me. That was the marker to say, right, you're onto a good thing here. So then I kind of properly, seriously thought about it, bought some more colours. So then they ended up being a series of 7 portraits, all male faces. And actually the letter four of them actually have more stitching to the first 3. So it was very interesting. I only ever showed them together once. So it wasn't that obvious. They're all kind of split up in the space that I was exhibiting in. But it was, it was interesting to even just see that such a small transition from those very first 3 pieces to the second part of that series, even though they still didn't have an awful lot of stitching in them, but there was more colours. So the lips had a bit more colour to them, and I had more colours to work in with the eyes. But they're all very minimal. They only have 2 kind of sections of faces that are put in, and some have one larger area maybe and a smaller bit, or they're not all exactly the same with the balance of features that are put in. And I put in a little bit of brown outlining just to give a little bit more of a hint to the form of the faces as well. So so it's really interesting to kind of look back at those pieces to compare to where I am now, 14 nearly 14 years later, to the anniversary of those first 3 portraits. But yeah, that's how I kind of went from a painter to a stitcher.
So then that gives you that detail that you craved, that ability. Yeah.
I mean, considering I've been, painting like that for quite a while, but there was a point that, I kind of, I wanted finer detail. I mean, I love, large, thick bits of paint, but sometimes you just need something a bit different, and sometimes that just doesn't work together in how you work, and you do just have to find different ways of working to create those other different kind of parts in the artworks that you want to make. So I've always been quite an experimental artist, really. Even as a student, I used to paint with makeup originally, and not paint. So I've always kind of played around with what I was using. So I'm not really surprised that I went on to use something different to paint, to kind of create something that could be seen as a bit painterly. So yeah.
Well, it's interesting to me, because the people that I've talked to, like you, who have an art background, painting, drawing, that kind of thing, there seems to be an incredible drive and certainly a willingness to just try anything. And you just let me see what happens. I mean, to paint with makeup or whatever it is, it seems like there's this ongoing question: what if I try this, and will I get the effect I'm looking for? And just throw it all in and see what happens. And I seem to get that out of you too.
Yeah. I mean, I can't see myself as being someone that would just do the same thing like for like a long, long time. I mean, I've been, 14 years stitching is quite, something for me, really. But again, I'm still evolving in how I stitch. But no, I do. I think, because artists or creative people, I think you're always striving to kind of, even if it's the same message that you're trying to get across in your artwork, I know that I'm always, you know, I'm trying to find the best way. What is the best way to create what I'm trying to say? And, you know, you might think you've got it with the first, you know, the piece that you're working on, but then you kind of get to it and go, no, actually, no, there's something missing. And then you're trying to find that new way that you can kind of convey. Because I suppose when I look back at my work as a student, actually, the themes that I was looking at then is not very different to what I'm doing now. But I worked in such different ways since, you know, so it's like nearly 22 years ago since I graduated. So, and in that time, I've used so many different mediums, photography, all sorts of ways, installations, to try and get that same kind of message across. So, you know, I will probably, you know, in another 20 years, I will probably still be trying to find that, the way. I know I won't find the perfect way, because I know I probably will never be, you know, satisfied in myself. If I'm satisfied, that would be the end of it. I won't be able to carry on anymore. But it's just finding the perfect combination of things to get that message that you're trying to convey. That's it, isn't it?
Because, see, that's interesting to me, because, you know, I think of, take, for instance, an oil painter. You know, they enjoy, you know, an oil painter enjoys doing landscapes and just works at it and tries to get good at it and tries to improve and blah, 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 blah. But it's always oil paint and it's always landscapes. And then there's this whole class of people like you where you're just always trying a new frontier. And faces obviously are something you've locked in on. So for you, it's how can I get that face, that one piece that says what I want it to say, and I really don't care what the technique is.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's that spot on, really.
Okay.
And that's, I'm kind of at that point again at the moment. I'm slightly evolving again at the moment. That's you've kind of hit me at a point where I'm slightly experimenting again, but still with stitching. Well, but then it's all about, you know, you kind of evolve and as you experience more about how you work. It's like with like the painting, you know, it's finding that different combination of maybe mixing paints to get, you know, with like maybe with a landscape, it's finding the light across the fields or something, and, you know, getting the perfect kind of dawn light on things. It's finding that kind of perfect, even brush, you know, experimenting with the different kind of brushes. It's always, you know, there's always a different kind of thing you learn from each thing that you use. And I suppose, you know, every so often, you know, you've got to a point where you feel like you've understood where you're at, and you kind of go, right, how can I improve, or can I just, you know, maybe not improve, but how can I change it or freshen it, you know, what's next to it? Yeah. And I suppose I do like to, obviously you said, I do like to experiment and things, and I don't want to get bored doing it, because I think if you get bored with doing what you're doing, I think it comes across in your work a bit as well.
So then you don't really have a comfort zone then. You don't have a place where you just settle in and you're comfortable and you'll do that all day long. It's a constant quest.
Yeah, it's a constant quest. Yeah. Huh. I find it's sometimes just like a battle, really, sometimes with it. I mean, an enjoyable battle. I don't, you know, right. I don't want to sound like I don't enjoy it. I do enjoy, but it is always, always trying to find that perfect kind of combination. Or, I mean, me and stitching, we're it's a bit of a battlefield with the kind of the speed and my lack of patience. So there's a whole different kind of level of battlefields with me and my work anyway at the moment. So yeah. Compared to the painting. So so different battlefields of painting, different battlefields of stitching. But it is enjoyable. I do want to say that.
Oh yeah. Well, no, that comes through. But see, that could, I guess that could be a comfort zone too. Constant constant battlefield to find the next thing that really, and you know, you may never find it, but that's okay because you had a good time getting there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Has art always been part of you, like from a child, drawing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think pretty much as soon as I was born, really. It's I didn't really know anything different. I come up, my family's quite creative, particularly my mother's side. I grew up seeing paintings done by my great grandmother on my grandmother's walls. And so I, you know, she was just a hobby painter. That wasn't a career or anything for her. And there were lots of pictures on the wall. And actually, I didn't realize until more recently, and I'm really quite annoyed with myself not knowing, that some of them were actually embroidered. And as a kid,
you're kidding me. It was right. It was right in front of you, and you didn't notice. Oh,
exactly. And this one, actually, this one piece. And it's of my grandmother, age 9, in her ballet outfit that my great grandmother had stitched. And it's quite small, and of course I've done two pieces of her myself, one again this year more recently. So there's this really lovely connection that she's now been created not only by her own mother but her granddaughter. So I just couldn't believe it when I was like, how did I not realise that these pieces were embroidered as well as, you know, painted pieces. But I think having seen things like that kind of just fed, you know, kind of my kind of love of drawing. I was, you know, we were allowed to kind of, you know, just paint and draw. And even if we weren't supposed to paint on the walls, we did. control with that still. But, we're all quite creative in different ways. There's a lot of photography in my family as well. And that was all I kind of focused on. That's well, I used to spend a lot of time sitting and drawing. I used to make up trees. That was one of my things I used to love, was just making up trees. And draw lots of people. Lots of sports stars, because you know, you get really interesting action shots and magazines. Formula One cars I used to draw as well, I think. That was a bit complex. But there was nothing else that kind of took my attention away. So the only thing really, it was obvious that I was going to have to go to carry on and go and do a degree in art and things, really. There wasn't, I think they would have been shocked if I suddenly turned around and said I want to be a biologist or something like that. It was just it. That was it. That was everything I wanted, you know, just wanted art materials as presents as a kid and things like that. So, yeah.
Boy, Formula One cars, I mean, yeah, that's, you know, you think, oh, why would anyone want to do that? But the lines and shapes on those things are.
Yeah, and it was just pencil. I didn't do colour versions. That was the thing. I liked the drawing. I didn't really like colouring in. I'm still very much colouring in books interests me, because I just wanted to, if there were people, I'd just colour in their faces or their arms and things. I didn't colour in the clothing.
Well, that's great. So you grew up in an absolutely creative environment, and so that was ingrained in you from day one, is, you know, go ahead and try, see what happens, experiment. So you never had any boundaries. I'm sure you had boundaries, but I mean, in terms of just culturing that what if aspect of your mind.
We've all kind of gone off and, you know, obviously not everyone went off and did degrees in art, but we've all in our own ways. We all have our kind of things that we do that are creative. So it's a nice kind of a lovely environment, really, to kind of grow up in and still be in. So there's always something kind of, someone's always done something of some sort. It's a lovely, inspiring kind of environment to be in that way, because you don't have that kind of negative kind of, by going, oh, what's she done now, you know, or what's she, you know, you, everybody's like, you know, really interested in what other people, you know, what we're all doing. So
yeah. Yeah, supportive, supportive.
Yeah.
Give it a try. See what happens. You'll learn something. Yes. Yeah. Good or bad, you learn something. Yep.
Exactly.
Exactly. So then you go to school, to art school. Did you have a career path in mind and then, like so many of us, went another direction?
No, I didn't have a plan at all.
Okay.
Really? I don't know really what I thought I was going to do. I certainly didn't think I was going to end up doing the community outside. That was kind of by chance. I kind of started doing that about a year after I graduated. I saw an advert for a gallery in my hometown that was opening up, and they were looking for artists that would come and work on projects, so I thought I'll go and see them. I put some work in their opening show for my degree show, and then I worked for them for about 8 years working on these different projects, doing stuff I had never done before. So it was quite a learning curve working 3D when I was so used to being kind of working flat. But I did work on murals and things as well. And then I started working then for other companies, and I still do a little bit of it, but not very often. I just kind of keep my hand in a little bit. But it was great, you know, it was really exciting. You didn't quite know what you were going to do, you know, being freelance, you know, it was each project slightly different, you know, each, because we'd always, we never wanted, even as if we did a lantern parade each year, we even changed that up so it didn't keep being, you know, it didn't have the same look each year for the public and things. Yeah. So it was always really nice because it kept you on your toes as well. And I think that, you know, that just kind of fits in with me generally with my own artwork. So it was, but of course, by doing that, I didn't really actually focus on my artwork that much because I was busy doing these other things. So that was my main focus, really.
Yeah. Well, there's a creative growth that happens there when you don't know what's going to hit you next, isn't there?
Yeah, I suppose it's it's a whole mix of different things. It can be quite scary. I mean, you're not quite sure what's gonna happen. But I mean, you know, I've been doing that for 20 years, and I mean, at the time you kind of go, oh my god, you know, sometimes it was quite trying. But actually, when you look back at things, it was such a great time. And really enjoyable. I learned so much. I learned about different materials, which then has kind of then helped me in my own work. And you know, you connect up working with different artists who come from different backgrounds as well. I've learned a little bit about using spray cans, all sorts of things. So it's really nice because then what I really enjoy is seeing how different people work. And then you know, kind of not necessarily compare, but you can go, oh yeah, I really like that kind of view of working, and you know, different people's styles as well, and how everybody can merge together. So it's a lovely kind of, you know, kind of sense of teamwork that you can, you know, that you do on certain projects.
Yeah,
which is so different to your own artwork because you're sitting there on your own. You don't necessarily have that kind of, you know, connection to anybody else. It's just you and your head kind of, you know, working away on it. So it's lovely to have that, those yeah, two sides of things, really.
Yeah, I wonder how many times today, subconsciously or without even realizing it at all, you draw off of that in your yeah, own work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. There was also the point of some of the things that I use now are actually because there was myself and another artist. We used a lot of fabrics and things in making costumes for the parades. And at the end of the day, you know, our workshop would get tidied up and these bits of fabric, these scraps were going to get thrown away. And I'm looking at them going, that's a bit too big to be thrown away. And I'd be collecting stuff. And I'm now using that stuff in my artwork. So, you know, there in a different kind of way as well, literally as actual remnants from the projects. And she took loads as well. We'd end up with bags full of materials in other projects, because you just can't throw it away. Too much, and too much of a recyclist in that sense. So yeah.
Well, and you still retain that today. I mean, you recycle and reuse things almost all the time, right?
Oh yeah, I did. I've done it this morning as well.
Yeah.
So this morning I'm just starting a new portrait, and I have just cut up a linen skirt of mine. It's faded. I don't use it anymore. It's got miscolored, and I couldn't bear to throw it away because I thought that's quite a large area of fabric that probably could be used. And linen, I really like using linen. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've just cut it up this morning. So yeah, the clothing doesn't leave, you know. I use all sorts of things that plastics, whatever. I don't like throwing away things that I reckon I could probably stitch into. So I much prefer to recycle stuff than to go and buy materials. I know I do have to buy them occasionally for certain things, but I do I much prefer to be reusing. There's that lovely kind of, for me, I have like then a more personal connection to some of the artworks. I look and I go, oh, that's my old jumper in that piece. Or I use material my mum made Irish dancing dresses for years and had loads of scraps of fabrics, and I've taken loads of the scraps. So some of the pieces have got bits of her fabric, so I'm looking at those going, oh yeah, that was in that dress. And yeah, and so it's, yeah, so there's lots of different kind of connections on a personal level to me by recycling different kind of either clothes or just scraps from people's projects. And we were talking off air, weren't we, about people kind of offering up materials. And so then I also have materials from other people that I've then used in projects. So then, and then I point it out to them. So then they see this kind of connection. Yeah. So then they connect differently to my artwork as well when they see it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fun. That's my shirt right there. Yeah. No, that's great. What your faces are captivating, and talk about how you go about those, because I mean the eyes are there. I mean, the eyes are everything, and they always are. And but then it's the partial faces. So you'll just have some fabric and some stitching that basically get us visually started on a face, and then there'll be an outline, and the rest of it will just be a ground cloth. And then sometimes you'll use use anything for a ground cloth. It scares me how much, I mean, you'll just use anything. But you can tell if you use a wallpaper that there's a purpose to that print of that wallpaper, or at least it seemed to me. There's an awful lot that goes into those faces, yet on the surface they look like such a minimalist presentation.
So there's normally layers and layers of meaning in my work. I won't necessarily talk about all of those. It's for me to kind of, I mean, you know, sometimes it's just, you know, just for me to kind of build a story of what that piece is about. Sometimes it's because how I work is often I have a title first to my portrait work in particular, and that will inspire the fabrics sometimes if there's a particular.
No, wait, back up the truck. You start with a title.
I start with a title. Yeah. So, maybe a bit back to front to people. Sometimes I don't, but I find it then hard to think of a title once a piece is made. So I work with a title that gives me the basis. So, well, okay. No, let's try and explain this properly.
Well, see, that intrigues me on a couple of levels, because I'm a magazine editor.
Okay.
And so I get, you know, and most of what we publish are contributed articles. And one of the first things I do with the manuscript is delete the head that the author sent.
Ah.
I mean, I just delete it because I'm going to delete it sooner or later anyway. And so the head and the deck, which is the little descriptive sentence or two about the article that gives the scan level thing, I just delete those. And then I edit the article, and after I've been through it two or three times, Then I come back, and then I know what the head and the deck are.
Okay.
And so I write them there. So if it just that you really hit me for a loop here, that you start with a title and then that drives the art. Wow.
Yeah. So I normally have I have ideas about some things, I write in my sketchbooks, numerous ideas. I have people in mind that I would like to do portraits for. I have people that kind of go, oh yeah, I'd love to be like one of the models in your portraits and things. Cause they're normally everybody I know, they're family and friends normally, because the work slightly shifted in the last couple of years. So in the early days, I would pick someone's face because of the look of them and not so much about the person. So they were just a pawn in the work, really. It didn't really matter that they were who they were. I just needed their face.
Yeah.
Where more recently, the works I've been making are much more connected to the person and their life. So I'm more picky about all of the elements of it, really. So how it works generally is I listen to music or whatever, I might hear something on TV and I have a notebook nearby, and something that might be said, or there might be a lyric or a bit of poetry that I've come across, or something just pops into my head, I write it down, and I write down often the reference comes from and things. So I have a long list of potential titles that I have because I just like certain, something stuck with me. And because I like, for me, the title is just as important as the actual visual image. My early works were quite simple. I had very simple titles. The first series was just called Fragile 1-7. I had another couple that were called Faith 1 and 2, but they were just blocks. So
the ultimate title cop out there. Yeah, just a complete cop out. Yeah,
exactly. And I feel that, if you're gonna tell a story, I feel I am a storyteller. So part of that really is the title. It's about not necessarily telling you everything about it, because I want people to make up their own meanings to them. And that's why there is any parts of faces. But the titles hint at certain things, or lead you down a certain way. So I have a title, then hopefully then, they could be sitting there for years, these things. And then someone comes along, or I just see something, I'm going, they will work with that title. So the one that I've got now that I'm about to work on, I have a title, I've taken the photo of the person, and I'm now just at that point of just working out the background fabrics of it. It's quite a dark, moody piece, that one. So I try to, so sometimes the titles connect me with fabric. So I have one portrait of a friend of mine, and I found it in the back of a sketchbook that I hadn't used for a little while. And I like to just get all the sketchbooks out once in a while and just go through them, because you might see something that you kind of gone, oh no, I'm not into that idea anymore, but might feel relevant now. And I saw this title, I saw this thing written down, and I don't know where I found it. I can't find it anywhere. And it's called, "And the softness of her cheeks were as soft as blossom." And I knew exactly straight away who I wanted to be the model. A friend of mine called Zoe has beautiful red hair, lovely creamy complexion, and just kind of made me think of like pre-Raphaelites and things. And so I knew I had to have blossom in the fabric as the title, and I just knew that the blossom was going to be in her cheeks, that a cheek was going to be away and the blossom was going to be showing through. So then I had to think about her colouring and the fabrics that would really enhance that as well. So I found a lovely jade fabric that's got pink blossom on it. I thought that is perfect with the hair colour and things. So that's how that kind of layering works out for me, using the fabrics. And I often use like cottons. And again, I was using sacking fabric, but it was dyed like an olive green to fit with her colouring for that. But the idea of the broken up faces, it kind of changes throughout time, why I use certain shapes and how I kind of present them. So the very first series were inspired by Egyptian tomb paintings. So in the British Museum, they had this amazingly fractured, tiny portrait. And you could just make out this face in there, but it's made up of lots and lots and lots of pieces. But I, as a student, looked at tomb paintings. I got a book out of the library that suggested to me my work at the time, but I didn't really think anything of it. I got the book out and it kind of logged in my head, and it's come out in the stitching instead. So it was these idea of these broken up faces that have gone onto the tombs, that giving you, you know, who is in the tomb, but you don't necessarily know who that person is really. And especially when they're broken up, you're then left to kind of put the pieces together as such. So my work started off with very broken up imagery. And then I kind of evolved over to, I really love peeling paint and ripped wallpaper and the kind of layers of colours and different patterns that you get. Especially when you go into old buildings that have been, you know, unloved and discarded, you get all these bits that are peeling away, and it's really this sense of history that you have about a place and possibly the people that have lived there. And so that then set me off on a series of work. So then when I'm out and about, I always have my phone on me. So I always have a camera of some sort on me. And I'm often the person that suddenly stops in the street and takes a photo of either someone's put a poster up and it's been ripped, but it's a really interesting shape. So I'll take photos of that, or where paint's peeling off the side of a building and things. So I have a large collection of different shapes. So the faces then started to echo shapes of ripped paper, and I was then building up different fabrics behind them to give that sense of layering up and different histories. And that's kind of still there. And obviously then I started using wallpaper. That's where wallpaper kind of come in from that, kind of how my that work was inspired. And now, even though the stories behind how I pick the people is different, the process is still the same. I still like to kind of connect in with the model, so I feel that it's connected to them. But obviously, titling wise, I'm much more picky with what I'm using for them. But the shapes of what I use, still kind of inspired by like the ripped wallpaper and peeling paint, because I love it so much. You get such interesting shapes from it, and it really, you know, you can really get to play with what you can show of someone's face there without, you know, if you were just left to your own devices, you could just have everybody looking face on and you just have, you know, slight basic tears to it. Right. But I really like that idea, that then that makes me really think about what pose the person's going to have in the photographs. If I'm taking the photographs, they live, you know, if I'm able to go and visit them and take photographs. Sometimes they had to just give me photographs and I just have to play with what I'm getting. So, you know, it's, you know, which is quite fun as well, because then that, you know, that gives you a different kind of edge of what you can, you know, you can't control everything as such. Right. But so I don't want there to be complete faces. The idea of these kind of fragments and just these odd tears, and it's a part of that idea of that sense of kind of history of these layerings of wallpapers and things. But there's also that we are multi-layered ourselves, and we're like onions really, aren't we? We just peel away different layers of us. We have like these kind of different sides to our personalities and the different parts of our lives in general. And I tend to pick up on parts of people's lives that maybe aren't the happiest kind of thing. Although I work, you know, I don't broadcast all those, but I kind of take those kind of slightly more maybe darker, slightly sadder moments in people, because everybody goes through that. And I think, you know, by kind of not advertising, but kind of showing that side of life, people, everybody can connect with it in different ways. And so the idea is that I don't want to say broken, I'm going to say broken, not broken, but we are fragile. We are, we have edges, and so the idea that we are, you know, we are visually broken up in my pieces are to do with that in a way, because I've described in the past that when I'm, especially the first series, I felt like I was almost mending and rebuilding people, even though it was very minimal stitching. It felt like I was kind of just putting them back together.
Mm.
And as well as kind of creating, in my mind, I was kind of going, right, we'll get you back together and we'll get, you know, we'll get you through this and things like that. For me, it's even though the what I could be thinking about their lives could have happened years ago and they're fine, but it's me kind of, I suppose it's in my head, I'm kind of trying to say to them it will be all right in a sense.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, the work is really kind of layered in that sense for those kind of pieces that I have all those different layers. I mean, not all my portraits are like that. I have very different themes that kind of work in and out of those, but in the whole I do kind of pick up, especially now, kind of those kind of little parts of people's lives that I can, and that's why I use people that I know, because then I know their, you know, I know their stories and things, and it's, you know, it'd be quite hard to then do that with someone that I don't know. I'd have to work it as a different kind of piece. It'd have to be more like my, when I was used to using people for how they look as such, then doing a more multi-layered, in my head, piece of artwork.
Yeah. It's so much fun for me to hear you talk about the shapes of torn and peeling paint, torn wallpaper and peeling paint. I used to do an awful lot of photography, and I did macro photography a lot. And that's what I enjoyed, is I see those shapes. And when you said, I see the shapes in peeling paint, it's, oh, yes. Yes, I relate to that. Because, yeah, there's a whole world of that. That
there is.
Most people just walk right by. Yeah.
Yeah, and the different kind of layers of colors, the color combinations can be amazing.
Yes.
You know, you wouldn't necessarily think of some of these colors. You kind of go, oh, well, how on earth? So, yeah. Yeah, I'm with you there. It's,
yep.
It's a nice hobby.
Yeah. Well, for me, walking around, you know, just a bunch of old buildings with a camera and a tripod and just looking for those kinds of things, old beat up doors and chipped up paint and brick walls and yeah, all that stuff. There's all kinds of things to look at. Yeah. Yeah. Talk about eyes. Are eyes hard for you?
No, I always start with the eyes. It's the slowest part of the portrait, because I want to, you know, I take my time. I want to get it right,
yeah,
because that's the person for me. There's something about a look, someone's look in their eyes. You know, once I feel like I've got it, then I can move on. There have been points where I've spent a whole day doing an eye and I've gone, that is just wrong. And I've completely just got rid of it and then start again the next day because something's just not been right. I've learned to go with my gut and not what my brain thinks I should be doing with certain, you know, where I should start necessarily, or maybe positioning things. Sometimes I've cut away maybe the wrong area and then I've gone, no, right, I'm just going to have to start again and put more fabric back down, and I am going to stitch in this area and things. But the eyes are always first, and once that's done, I can move on, and it all speeds up after that. And I really enjoy stitching eyes. I really enjoy drawing eyes. Was it the windows to the soul is what,
right,
you say,
right,
isn't it? And I think that's right, really. I think you can tell a lot about someone in the, just with their eyes.
Well, that's with your work. Your work is a classic example of that, where so many of your pieces are not much more than the eyes.
Right.
Yet you don't need much more, because what you've done with the eyes, you know, I'm locked in. You got me. Yeah.
And you know, it's always interesting because obviously I know the person that I'm stitching. So I, you know, I can see the eyes that I'm stitching. So it's always interesting for other people looking at them that might not necessarily know the person, but they often come, you know, the one thing they'll comment on is the eyes. So it's my most important and probably most stressful part of the piece to like, you know, I have to really sit and focus on it and really kind of be in the zone to do it.
So once you get them and get them right, then the rest of the work just flows right out of that then.
Yeah. Cause you've then kind of, I feel like I've then locked into the person and I can just then kind of crack on and just work my way out from there.
I love hearing how you folks work. I really do. It's fascinating to me. All right, we're going to run out of time, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the Society for Embroidered Work.
Okay.
Because I follow that Instagram thing, and it's just a parade of interesting things. So you're a founder of that group?
I am. So it was myself and Kat Frampton. So that came about in 2018 on Instagram. Kat had posted, now I'm trying to think. We're both on, we're in different parts of the UK, and we're both organisers of our open studio events. And she's on the committee board of hers, and a painter who isn't on the board turned around to her and said, yeah, but what you do isn't art. And that she posted about it, and that just exploded, basically, because then all these people started commenting on various different things. And I have no idea what I wrote, but I joined in, but I can't remember what I wrote at all. And she sent me a message and said, we need to do something about this. People shouldn't be treating us this way, which I completely agree. And so we kind of thought, we had a look around, and there's lots of textile groups. And you've got obviously the Embroiderers Guild and things like that. But we were looking, we couldn't find something that was actually just saying that it's an art form. So we wanted to create something that was to promote stitched art. I mean, we call it embroidery, but actually that is just a really loose term, because there are lots of people that, you know, don't really fit into some of the different groups. They kind of fall into cracks because of the way that they work. And so it was a way of kind of just bringing together everybody that creates artwork, that it's almost like power in numbers, and to promote worldwide that, you know, stitched art is art. That's what we say. And so we set it up, and we had no idea if anybody would join us. We thought it was just going to be the two of us. And it turned into a massive beast. And you know, the main aim is, you know, it's fine art, guys. It's, you know, but you know, the art world is very snobby, and it's very clicky, and it's very competitive, and trying to get your work in shows is very hard, because I mean, yes, there are a lot of artists out there, but it's, you know, it's educating, it's trying to educate the curators, the public, other artists, that what we make, regardless if it's machine, hand, whatever, is just as fine art as the painting that's hanging on the wall next to mine. So it's about getting the work into galleries, and not necessarily the textile shows. It's getting them into your more mainstream, you know, just art as general shows. And it's been great to see the connections that have been made so far, you know, because the artists are labeled on the website by country. And we had our first show in 2019 in London, and people from around the world in the show. There was work from Australia, Germany, America. The two American artists came over to the show, met, and have connected up because of it. And I've seen other people kind of realize that other people live near them as well, because it is, you know, like I said earlier, you know, working on your work at home can be very lonely.
Yeah.
And trying to find other people near you, where I think fiber art is more highly regarded in America than it is over here, though it is getting better. There have been some bigger shows that have had textile art and in them, and people like artists like Grayson Perry with his tapestries has certainly helped highlight that kind of work. But it's still a long slog. I've been very fortunate, you know, I keep up the good fight entering into things. I'm very competitive, that's why I quite like the art world, I think. I will pitch, you know, I still call myself a painter, and so I believe what I make are still paintings or drawings. So I don't see what I'm doing is any different to what I was doing earlier in my career and to what other people are doing now. So I will pitch myself into things that are called portrait painting shows. You know, sometimes I've got in, sometimes I don't, but then that's the luck of who's on the selection panel. But I think, you know, when you see other people then entering into these shows and getting in, it gives other people confidence to enter them as well. And I'm definitely seeing more and more people getting accepted into shows and actually winning prizes as well, which is great. And that's not just, you know, in the textile shows, that is in other art shows as well. So I mean, you know, it's improving very slowly, but there's a long, long way to go. There's a lot of education that needs to be done to the public, because I mean, when I went to Birmingham, when I was highly commended, when I went up to get my certificate, the person that gave it to me turned to me, goes, "Oh yes, my mum does needlepoint," and I was like, "But this isn't needlepoint." But you know, I thought that's fine, you know. But I still get things like that said to me now, yeah. So later. And trying, I mean, it's very hard to explain what you make without making it sound twee and make it sound like maybe what their grandmother or great grandmother might have made, but it's not like it at all. So it's about finding the right language to describe the work that we do, because people have these ideas about what embroidery, what, you know, textiles. They, you know, there's ingrained thoughts about it. So it's, yeah, there's a lot of education that's got to be done. And by hopefully getting more of that work into shows, that's the way we can do it. I mean, I often sit in shows and work if I can, you know, get the opportunity, because that's the best way of explaining to people how you work. Because, you know, explaining something might not work, and a lot of people work visually. So when you show someone, or you know, you've videoed yourself working on the machine and you can show them how it's worked, then they have a much better understanding of then what goes into the work, mm-hmm. on the wall. I think people don't really understand that as well, about how much work goes into these pieces that people make.
So it's
all about just kind of getting people's work out there and showing that, you know, it's just as good as the Turner and the on the wall.
That's right. Oh yeah, yeah. That's my favorite, and I mean that in a negative way. My favorite question: hey, look at what I just finished. Ooh, how long did it take you? A half hour. Knocked it out. It was no problem.
Yeah.
You know, really, this is simple stuff. Don't worry about it. Took forever.
That's one of the questions you always get.
Yeah.
How long did that take you?
And
because people still believe there's paint in my work, so I always have to say, and they say, "What? So you stitched on top of paint?" No, it's just stitching. So yeah, it's. I think people find it. Yeah, I think it blows their mind sometimes what you can actually do with a, you know, a needle and embroidery floss or whatever you choose to stitch with. Right? It's you know, it's exciting because people are quite, you know, going, "Oh, never seen anything like this before." I'm going, "Really?" Like, there's a lot of us out there. So, yeah. But it's going to take a while. But there's definitely changes. I've one of our things we did do, we wrote a letter to the Royal Academy, because in their summer show, the big summer show, they used to have they have different categories. So you've got architecture, photography, painting, blah, blah, blah. They used to have textiles. They don't anymore. And although I've had work accepted into there, but I think I had to write it under mixed media.
Oh.
I can't remember now. I might have put it as painting, but I might have put it as mixed media. So it's a really funny one. But I've noticed that more open call exhibitions are now putting textile as a category, and will say it's an accepted discipline that you can enter, because often it's not one that is mentioned. So I will just enter it anyway and just see, and not know if I get rejected because they just don't accept that style of work, or it just wasn't their thing. I don't know. But yeah, it's something that is popping up more and more. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's frustrating to me. Some of the most beautiful needlework in the world comes from Europe and the churches and all the gold work and Art Nouveau and all those things, just stunning, mind-blowing needlework. And then people look at it, well, that's not art, that's woman's work,
It's, yeah.
Spare me.
Yeah, I know. And especially, you obviously stitch.
Yes.
As well. So, I know plenty of men that are stitchers. And it's, they kind of go, oh, really? It's almost if they're like this, oddball kind of thing. I'm thinking, well, there was a lot of men that did used to stitch. There was, we had a show in, I can't remember what year, it was a few years ago now, about 2017, I guess. And it was all about embroidery and things. And actually, a lot of the work that was in that was actually created by men.
Yeah.
So, again, it's education, isn't it? People just have this prefixed idea of how it's made and what, where it's made. They all think, I think we all just sit there in nice, like, kind of smocks in a nice chair with a nice big hoop.
Right.
Listening to classical music, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a slow thing to change. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The perception that it's a bunch of women at afternoon tea just sitting there yakking with their needlework. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my mind is blown on a daily basis of like the work that I keep coming across on social media and what people use. I mean, I like to experiment, but there are people that really kind of, I'm like, there's people that are using concrete or stitching into bark and things. And it's like, whoa, like how on earth do you do that? So it's really inspiring, and we've just got to find a way of getting more out there. And that's why we just say, just enter things, just put your big brave pants on and do it. That's the best thing, isn't it? Just you won't know unless you try.
Social media has a lot of negatives, I think more negatives than positives. But if there is a positive, particularly in needlework, it's exactly that. You can go on social media and see the amazing creativity from all over the world with all manner of materials. And it is really something to see what people's minds come up with. It really is.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Emily, this was fun. Thank you.
Oh, it's great fun.
Yes. Yeah. Really enjoyed it. All right,
Thank you.
Emily Tull, TULL.co.uk is the website. She's also on Instagram and Facebook. Go visit that and check out her work, because it will inspire you and get you thinking, I guarantee you. It's really good stuff. And Emily, thanks so much for making the time for this.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Gary. It's great fun.
All right, and thanks to everyone for listening.